invitation. As the introduction stated, this is ongoing, very much work in progress with Ben Schumacher, who I saw recently. I think to begin with, after watching the recording of Ben's talk, Ben's colloquium talk, I want to reiterate a warning that he issued. In no way are we trying to claim that the systems that we are looking at are suggested as an alternative way of looking at quantum mechanics. In fact, we don't have any particular physical system in mind that we're modeling with these modal systems. And I even avoided a joke I wanted to tell by way of setting the title. I was tempted, since the moral of the story, if I do it right today, is that there are strong analogs in modal quantum theory with the types of structures in actual quantum theory that we use to model the time evolution of open quantum systems. And so I was really tempted to title the talk today, Modal Quantum Theory, the Motion Picture, as opposed to Modal Quantum Theory, the Motion Picture. But I avoided that because, well, for one thing, they're recording this, and this can live on and haunt me later, but I've kind of given up the game anyway since I told you. But I also just didn't want to leave the impression that somehow we have any hope that this thing is modeling the motion of anything. We don't have anything in mind that we're modeling. And in fact, this started out as a mathematical, and in fact, even in some ways, a pedagogical exercise. I put this slide up here. It's a slightly modified version of one of the first slides Ben put up in his colloquium, just by way of reminder that we're working over a vector space that need not have an inner product. And in fact, many of the examples we look at, many of the simple examples we'll look at, in fact, we'll see an example of this at the end of the talk, are not just finite dimensional vector spaces, but finite vector spaces where we can work over a finite field. And when you work over a finite field, you have to have the situation that you don't have an inner product. If you don't understand why, just think of chalk. Where's chalk? Oh, here it is. Just think of this vector and take what you would think of as the standard inner product over Z2. You'll see that the norm of that thing is zero. Now, that's not a proof that no inner product exists. How do I know there's not some other fancy map? But when you realize that any inner product, the norm of any vector would have to be non-negative, you are then stuck with the property of finite fields not even having a notion of positivity. So not only do we not have inner products, with no inner products, there's no notion of perpendicular, there's no notion of orthogonality, there are no perps. There are no outer products. So if the requirement is for positivity, one of the things that you want for a positive set is for the zero vector not to be, you can't add yourself up to get zero. Of course, you add any element of Z2 to the two-dimensional vector space over Z2 to itself once, you add two instances of the same vector, you're always going to get zero. So positivity is just right out the window for that. So if you state, now I've never seen any other development of inner product that doesn't use positivity, and
maybe it's not useful. Lorentzian inner products don't use positivity. They're useful in their context. Maybe the statement is in this quantum context. We need positivity.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah, you're right. There are inner products, so there are norms with with complicated signatures, I think is the, yeah, the term. Yeah, that's certainly true. And when you talk about null vectors, I haven't thought about that, to be honest with you, but my guess is that's not going to work. I mean, even in special relativity, when you restrict yourself to a space-like region, you work with the standard norm, and we don't have any such regions in vectors, finite vector space, finite dimensional vector spaces over finite characteristic. Now, you might, there are infinite vector spaces over finite fields. You may be right in a structure like that, but certainly in terms of the finite dimensional vector spaces, I can't give you a proof right now, but my guess is you're not going to be able to pull that off. Okay, so having said all that, you might wonder, why in the world would anybody be interested in these systems to begin with? And the answer for me is from about 5 years ago. In fact, it occurred while I was attending a conference here at Perimeter. I was sitting in the theater of ideas and had an idea. And the idea was, I had listened to Bill Wooters. I don't think Bill was talking in that particular instance about his discrete Wigner distributions, or Wigner distributions over discrete spaces, or however he phrases that. But I had seen Bill give that talk, and I always thought that that was really pretty mathematics and nicely small scale. And I realized that if you just work with a finite dimensional vector space over a finite field, you do get entanglement. You can talk about entanglement. So one of the things that I do from time to time is work with beginning students, undergraduates, trying to get them interested in quantum mechanics, quantum information theory, or even quantum foundations. And I was wanting a quick and dirty way of convincing them that entanglement exists, and it's not an artifact of the way you pick the bases, as long as you respect the subsystem structure. And the nice thing about these finite dimensional vector spaces over finite fields is, well, everything's finite. It's a counting argument. In just Z2 tensored with itself, you've only got 16 elements. Six of them are entangled. The other, well, nine of them are non-zero product states, and you've got the product tensor, or the zero tensor. And that just struck me as a really nice, handy thing to have to present to students. And I said something to Schumacher about it, and we were involved in other really more complicated, complex, and recondite things, and I just couldn't get him interested in it at the time. And so anyway, and besides, that was about the time that we were starting working on the book. And so I guess about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, I suggested it to him again, and let me back up. I also had the wild hope that perhaps we could use these finite dimensional vector spaces over finite fields, finite vector spaces, as test beds for properties in quantum mechanics and quantum information theory. Perhaps if we found out something to be true in the finite case, it would suggest methods for deriving an analogous fact in actual quantum mechanics. And about a year after having that thought, I ran across a paper by Jean-Pierre Serre, who's a well-known number theorist. He's so well-known that I know him, and I'm not a number theorist. I am a mathematician, but that's how you tell someone is a famous number theorist. Somebody outside of number theory knows them. And anyway, Serre has this lovely paper about classes of problems in algebraic geometry, where you can answer questions about structures over C by looking at the analogous question, or really the same question, rephrased in terms of structures over ZP. And so this gave me some hope that this idea I'd had about a test bed maybe wasn't so crazy after all. But anyway, that's the motivation behind looking at these things initially, again, from my point of view. Now, as I said, there are no inner products. Do we have anything to point with? You know, a hockey stick would do. Oh, there it is. You know, thought I'd seen such things in the recordings. Anyway, we don't have inner products, but we do have a dual space. And at least formally, the dual vectors are they're mappings from the vector space into the field of scalars. And as I was going to say, at least formally, they act very much like you want to think the inner product acts in standard vector spaces over fields of characteristic zero. The action of the dual an element in the dual space is just to pick out the coefficients of the vector expressed in the corresponding basis. And that's one difference in these general vector spaces where you don't take into account the existence of a standard non-negative norm is you have to specify to know the correspondence between the vector and the dual element. You have to specify the entire basis. And so there's in algebraic terms, there's just no natural correspondence between vectors in the state space V and elements of the dual. You have to specify the entire basis. To get the mathematical preliminaries out of the way early on, and I promise we'll get to some analogs of quantum theory here in just a moment. I do want to point out, even though we don't have perps, we do have the notion of an annihilator. And the annihilator is a subspace, as it turns out, of the effect space. Given a set of states in your state space, the annihilator is just a set of all those elements that are impossible for the set of effects in the annihilator. And so the annihilator is always a subspace, and it has these other properties, one that we didn't list up there, I think, because for some reason I decided not to, is the annihilator of, say, A in the state space is A. And in fact, that assignment is natural, where the assignment between the vector space and the dual space isn't. So we're going to take advantage of this, particularly this property, that A and B have the same annihilator, if and only if they span the same subspace. We're going to see that spans play the same role here in modal quantum theory that convex hulls play in regular quantum theory. And that's probably a phrase that I may say, well, in fact, I see that as my task today, is to point out those strong analogs between what I take to be strong analogs, between this system, this modal quantum theory, and actual quantum mechanics. Because after all, if we're going to have this test bed idea, those analogs have to be kept in mind, and the idea is to develop the analogs for open systems. So one of the things that we use quite a bit in discussing open systems is the notion of mixed states. And just intuitively, mixed states are sets of states. And we think of mixed states, mixtures. And two mixtures have are equivalent if they lead to the same set of possible and impossible effects. So, well, given what we said earlier, two sets in our state space are equivalent if their annihilators are equal. And since the annihilators are subspaces, we can conclude that the subspaces spanned by those original sets are the same in the state space. So mixtures are equivalent if and only if they span the same subspace in the state space. So we make the move to just refer to the mixed state as subspaces of the state space. Every subspace of a state space corresponds to a mixed state, and every mixture, every collection of possible states given a set of effects is corresponds to a subset of this or subspace rather of the state space. So to clue us, ourselves in that we're working with subspaces, we try to always write this script Roman letter that corresponds to the Latin Roman letter for set. We try to use the script notation as a clue that we're really working with a subspace. And certainly mixtures of mixed states, if we take their join, this structure respects mixtures. Products of mixed states are simply the products of each of the subspaces in the subsystems. And the time evolution of mixed states. And this is written to remind ourselves of the situation in quantum mechanics where you'd multiply a density matrix, which you don't have here, by an operator, by a linear map, a unitary map. In this case, it's really just an image. The image of M under T is what gives us the time evolution we take. That is going to always be a subspace. So what we take as the close analog to unitary maps, invertible maps between spaces, between vector spaces, those naturally give us mixed states in the image. Okay. Now, just considering a collection of states as forming a mixture is one way of creating a mixed state. But you know, in actual quantum mechanics, we take the convex hull. In this, we take the linear span. But in actual quantum mechanics, another way of arriving at mixed states is by way of collection of conditional states arising from an entangled state for a larger system containing systems A and B as subsystems. So we can think of, you know, the question arises, can we think of a mixed state associated with B given an A effect for A? And this is how we do it. It's again analogous to the notion of a partial inner product. And so we say that for any effect in our B system, this state is the conditional state because whenever we take this mapping, this is now an element in our dual space for the AB system, we get the right notions of or the right results for possible and impossible for the B subsystem.
Does the order matter?
Which order is that?
A comma B as opposed to B comma A.
Well, you want to be able to identify which subsystem is which. In some sense, if I wrote this as B upper B, A upper A, and this actually will come up later, that would be the same thing as this. You don't. It's not the order so much that matters. It's the reference letter.
I understand that, so it doesn't matter if
you
do A first, B later.
Right? No, you'll get a conditional. It's just that if you do B first, you get a conditional state in the A subsystem. Okay. All right. So if we want to consider the situation where we haven't run a measurement on the A system, then what is the right state, what is the right mixed state to assign to to be. And the idea is that we look at all the collection of all these conditional states for all the possible effects in the A subsystem. All right.
We have to run over all the A's and V star.
Right, V star A. Okay, so did I skip something?
You went over a spot.
Yeah.
Go backwards. Another backwards.
Thank you. Okay. Okay, so, and again, this is just reiterating what we had on the previous slide. This, again, is always a subspace. And so given, if we restrict ourselves not to, to all possible A effects, but just a basis set in the effect space, then we can also describe this this mixed state in the B system. So I guess to answer your question is, the original statement is in terms of all the effects, but we can restrict ourselves to the basis set. And so this does suggest that this reduction to a subsystem is very much like a partial trace, okay, in actual quantum mechanics. And so this is the notation to remind ourselves that we're reducing to system, we're reducing over the system A or ignoring the system A by looking at this set. So if you like, this is just notation for that situation. And again, it's good enough to restrict ourselves to a basis set, even though that's stated in the original format. Okay, so indeed we can get mixed states, these subspaces for subsystems, as the states that you would ascribe to a subsystem, or a state for a subsystem, arising from an entangled state for the overall system. How did I do that? I'm glad you're watching. There we go. All right. So, yes.
Is this actually somehow literally the same thing? And if you apply this to the usual quantum mechanics, you could start with the density matrix for the AB joint system, and you could trace out B, or whatever it was, trace out A, and then you could take the space span by what was the support of what you got.
Yeah, I think
that exactly the same space that you're talking
that,
about here?
I think so. The reason I'm hesitant to just say yes, that's right, is at least when I do actual quantum mechanics, I take full advantage of that natural correspondence between states and the state space and effects. And in fact, maybe that's one of the morals of this, one of the lessons of this way of looking at it. Maybe we should always think of measurements as subsets of the effect space, subsets of the dual. But I don't see anything that would, I mean, nothing that I've said here doesn't apply to a vector space.
It looks like it.
So, and so this, in situations where you have an inner product that works, where the action of the dual does, by the Riesz representation theorem, does represent the inner product, right? That, in fact, you can get all linear functionals as linear combinations of those things. I think it is exactly the same thing. OK. I'm looking at my collaborator, hoping he'll...
except that you don't start out with a density operator. You start out with assumptions. You don't have any... The states are never represented by operators in this. There's something else. They have less structure.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, yeah. I think if you replace the subspace with convex hull.
Or support.
What is support?
The
row is it support?
Possible, yeah. That sounds plausible.
Okay. In actual quantum mechanics, we do have a way of mapping density matrices to density matrices. So the question now again is, can we do the same thing in modal quantum theory? And whatever a generalized effect would be, it would have to be a mapping from our subspace onto the set of possible and impossible. And we take as a reasonable assumption about such maps is that they'd have to respect mixtures. And if gamma is possible or maps to possible for the linear span, it has to also map either of the subspaces to possible. And conversely, if it maps the linear span to impossible, it has to do the same for both of those subspaces.
So,
yes, sir.
So that suggests to me that since you're calling it a postulate, it suggests to me that you could do something else, like saying gamma might be possible for m, even though it's not possible for either of m1 or m2. Is that conceivable?
It's conceivable.
Yes.
But...
okay, so if you went down that path, what would happen?
Just haven't ever explored it.
It's kind of analogous to what we thought the anthropomorphic code was. That's more. Sorry.
What? I'm sorry.
Oh, well, yeah. This has to do with a totally different. This has to do with a possible interpretation of quantum mechanics, based, which I shouldn't get off into now.
Oh, okay.
But that exactly that kind of thing happens. So. It can be that a certain thing is true and a certain other. So a certain thing is A is false. A doesn't happen. Event A doesn't happen. Event B doesn't happen. But the event A or B does happen.
Yeah.
Like in its two slip.
Yeah, so it's a world where A and B both need to be there for something to happen. That's what I'm thinking.
I see. If you just accept the mixture interpretation of the mixed state, so a mixed state really is simply representing a set of possible pure states, then what this says is that something is, that an effect is possible, provided it's possible for one of the possibilities that the mixed state encompasses, that that mixture encompasses. So it's sort of analogous to the fact that, or the corresponding postulate in quantum theory, that the probability of an effect is a linear functional on the density operators, because you can imagine a density operator arising as a probabilistic mixture of other density operators, and just applying the rules of probability, you would predict that.
Yeah, I mean, this other thing is in the history's framework, and something I'd love to talk to you about afterwards, because I see certain close analogies between this, and a lot of differences, too.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the motivation. It just seems to me that you could try something else and perhaps get a rather interesting structure where you two do otherwise. That was my motivation, which obviously Raphael's thought about more than me.
And it sounds like a lovely thing to put a student on. What's that?
It's terrible. You can obviously imagine cases where some gammas respect and other gammas don't respect.
Sure. And that's one of the nice things about being honest about it being a postulate. It is just an assumption. Sure, can we make another assumption? And Yeah, I'm sure I'll steal your idea somehow. So anyway, given the postulate, so given whatever this mapping's going to be, we set our set of states in the state space as the union of all the states for which gamma is going to map those to impossible. So gamma is impossible for that subspace. And it's going to be impossible for any subspace, if and only if it's a subspace of that space. And so we just make the identification of gamma with the annihilator of Z. Because if we, as I said, when we take the annihilator of the annihilator, and I wish they'd left that feature in, we'd see that gamma naught would equal Z. And given a basis assignment, that's exactly the natural thing to have. So these subspaces in your effect space turn out to be the natural notion of generalized effect, again, given this postulate. Okay. So the close Gibbs is a close analog, or what I take to be a close analog to the notion of a POVM in actual quantum mechanics, that you get a generalized measurement, not just a generalized effect, but a generalized measurement if you have a set of effects for which the intersection of the annihilators is zero. Or alternatively, and this is the bit that reminds me of the condition on POVMs, that they span the entire space. And this is a bit of notation that we're going to use in the last part of this talk. When we get to the close analogs of completely positive maps. And it's really generalizing the notion of restriction. It's the notion of conditioning. So we're going to say that we condition over an effect for the A system by looking at the action of the duals in the effect space on our elements of the subspace in the overall system. And we note that this conditioning operation respects mixtures in both places. And again, just to remind you, in some sense, we've already seen this operation before. If you like, it's a generalization of the notion of partial trace, the partial trace analog, I should say, in modal quantum mechanics, this reduction operation that we had, where the conditioning set is over the set of all effects. So if you have a measurement so that the whole space is spanned, this conditioning over such a measurement does give you back that notion of reduction that we've looked at before. Okay, so now we get down to the what I take to be the main task of this talk, and I only have 20 minutes for both the talk and further questions, or I don't win cash prizes and gifts, according to Rob. So let me go on. The way we approached this was try to think of what are our reasonable maps, generalized maps, on what would turn out, what we want to think of as the analogs to open systems. And again, one of the properties that you might want for such maps is that you would want maps to respect mixtures. And I guess I'm showing my how far I've traveled from my abstract algebraic roots. My advisor would probably smack me for saying, look, it respects joins, not mixtures. But we're wanting to think of these things as mixed states, or as the analogs of mixed states, so strongly that we call them mixed states. The other possible property you want for such a map is you want to your map to not map non-zero things or possible things into impossible. So the close analogs here are to trace preserving, and I attempted to say that's a close analog to positive, but we've already talked quite a bit about the notion that positivity for just elements in our scalar space or scalar field is a problematic notion to begin with. It seems a little odd to say, well, this is positivity, but it certainly is an analog of, or is in fact equivalent to, linearity. It's the action of an extended map, or what we want to say is a map on an extended system. And of course, our maps are maps that are playing the role of time evolution. I guess I'm trying to be a little weaselly about the notion of time. Yeah, that's what we have in mind to create the analog. But we're just talking about the action of an invertible map.
Linearity employs the first thing has to be there.
Yeah. So. I'm sorry. Yeah, the top one where you respect mixtures.
This one should
respect spins.
You don't want this to be invertible.
Not on the subsystem necessarily, but the question arises: can we think of that as a reduction to that subsystem from an invertible map on a larger system? Okay, so yes, but right. Okay, we take as given that the type M maps, where it respects mixtures and doesn't map anything except zero to zero, we take those as fundamental to the types of maps we're talking about, and so these further categories of types I, L, and E. Assume that we have type M to begin with. And so as further requirements, we want to consider type E maps that we can think of as maps on our object system that can be thought of as restrictions of invertible maps on larger systems. Okay, and again, remembering that this is our close analog to partial trace, this is our close analog to unitary evolution, it's just invertible mapping. These will turn out to be the maps that are represented by unitary time evolution or unitary evolution on a larger system, and then tracing out over the environment that starts out in a fixed state. Okay? And type L maps, I think I've already given away what I think of as the closed analog here. These would be the analogs of Krauss operators in actual quantum mechanics. So is there some kind of representation for our mapping on our object system that can be given by linear maps on that system, not necessarily invertible, all right? But they do have to satisfy this condition that the intersection of their kernels is zero, much like this is analogous to the completeness requirement on our Krauss operator, set of Krauss operators. And then the last one is the type E. Just as with the respecting mixtures, I was tempted to think of that as positivity. I was tempted to think of this as the analog to complete positivity. But again, you know, positivity, what is that in this general framework? But nonetheless, the way we can phrase it here is that we have a type E map if reduction, or conditioning rather, and extension commute with each other. In other words, I can either condition first and then let my system evolve with respect to the action on the object system given by the given map, or I can extend to a larger system and then condition on the reference system. And even though positivity, what's that, is in effect, that's in some ways that's the upshot of complete positivity. If I extend and I act on my reference system in a trivial way, I still want to have a meaningful map. At least that's the game that's played in actual quantum mechanics. So that's the stage, or I hope I've set the stage for analyzing the types of maps you might.
Isn't there somehow a stronger condition that it's? I don't know if it's actually stronger, but it seems stronger that it could be compatible with any evolution of the second system. Is it clearly the same?
Are those equivalent? The only time
in the usual case, it's equivalent, but here I don't know.
Here, in complete positivity, you extend in a particular way, like a tensor product operator. But since these maps are not maps on operators, we really don't know what that means. In complete positivity, it is sufficient to assume that if you extend them by the identity on the other system, then it always makes sense. That you always get a positive map. That's sufficient for complete positivity.
That's right. But isn't it also physically relevant that in fact it's compatible with any other evolution on the second system? I mean, in this case it follows. It follows, so you don't have to ask it a separate question. I'm just wondering whether it follows in this case. Or maybe there's no. In other words, can you find some joint thing? I'm not even sure it's well posed, but I think it is. So you would have a separate evolution here.
It's not a separate evolution because we don't really know how to separate the evolutions in general. We simply say there exists an evolution on the larger system. I don't know if it's separate, but what we do say is that it commutes with the process of forming conditional states. So the diagram in the previous, you can either evolve the whole system and then condition, or you can condition first and then evolve the subsystem. And we just say we don't know anything about ERS except that, and we just simply assume that it commutes with conditioning, that conditioning could happen before or after the evolution, and it doesn't matter. You get the same thing.
Yeah, and maybe what I'm saying is wrong, but what I'm thinking is that the intuitive meaning of complete positivity is that it's some evolution in this mode. It's some evolution such that the presence of another state completely uncoupled to it doesn't somehow invalidate it as a possible evolution. And that other system could be doing anything, right?
Yeah, that's true.
It could be.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering,
but this is the definition. I mean,
right? I'm just.
The question is right. Whether there is another definite, like type F, which would be a stronger condition, which would be analogous to the stronger, logically stronger form of complete positivity.
I'd like to hear more about that. an idea. Okay. Somebody let me loose on a computer. That's what the problem is. Yes, here we go. There. Sorry. Sometimes those fancy bells and whistles come back to bite you. Here's one reason for why we haven't considered anything different, at least to this point, is that we will show that the type L, type I, and type E mappings are in fact equivalent. Okay, so if you and again, this does suggest to me that there is this analog, because the analogs between unitary representations for completely positive maps and Krauss representation, I think those analogs are fairly strong, and we'll show that this type E condition is equivalent to those. And as I say, what I want to talk about right now is not really give the proof of this equivalence, but more or less indicate what the proof looks like. Talk a little bit more in detail about this implication that's not showing there. And I insist that this is a true theorem in spite of what's staring you in the face. So at least I'm convinced it's a true theorem. And so I just want to indicate that the type L implies type I. The idea is to remember the type L was the one where we had the mapping represented by these linear operators, and so we manufacture an invertible operator, or manufacture this operator, and show that it has the properties of being invertible on the overall system. This is really the key move in doing that. So that's all I'm going to say about the proof of that implication. The rest of it is mostly just unpacking definitions, as is the implication of type I implies type E. Once you assume that you have invertible evolution on an overall system, you then define a map on the overall system this way and show that it reduces to the given map on the system. And one of the key facts here is that reduction commutes with conditioning. In fact, one of the things we proved along the way of doing this is that, in general, conditioning by one system and then another is independent of the order in which you do that. I that's what I was referring to when I thought you were asking about the order of conditioning. When I first looked at this, I thought, oh gee, I've got the tensor product order out of whack. But that doesn't matter. It's the operation of the dual elements on the respective state systems. So the fact that those commute is really, really pretty straightforward. So now the hard part, proving that type E implies type L. The game here is very much like the proof in the equivalence of complete positivity to Krauss representation and unitary representations. So we want to prove that these type E maps, the ones where restriction commutes with with conditioning, I'm sorry, where conditioning commutes with extension, that we're going to take that as given and mimic the idea of taking a completely positive map and in some sense teasing out the characteristics of that map, the statistics for that map, by using a completely entangled state. So this is the KR vectors form a basis for the R subsystem, the reference subsystem. KS vectors form a basis for the system of interest. And this entangled state we use as a way of linearly associating with states in the S subsystem effects in the reference system. Okay, it will give us a linear association between those two. At least from my standpoint, that's not just fully analogous to the step we do in the representation theorem in actual quantum mechanics. It's completely stealing the idea, at least for my part. Once we have those statistics, or at least that linear association, this is where we carry out what I think of as tomography on the map. We use that entangled state and look at the images here. And so we, from those images, we define our candidate linear maps in terms of this action of this effect in R, this conditioning on the R subsystem on each of the image elements here after the action of our map on our input completely entangled state. And so then once we had this definition, we basically turn the crank. We've defined our space to be this object, which I guess is on the previous slide. And so this is where we're using our E condition to commute through the extension and commute out the conditioning. And from there, it's simply, well, this is defined here, and just make the appropriate substitutions. And also, simultaneously, we're teasing out or taking advantage of our definition of conditioning. We're just letting the effects in gamma, the G effects, or the R effects, G, act on RS. And since this is a linear association, that was the main point of the previous slide, we get this linear representation for our map that has this property, and it's easy to show that the span of those images is the whole space. So this is indeed a type L map. So that completes our proof of the equivalence, the overall equivalence. So if you're given maps that respect mixtures and don't map it, something possible to impossible, the Li and E are all equivalent. So every map that's type E can be represented by invertible evolution on a larger system, or at least an invertible mapping. We certainly think of it as analogous to evolution from actual quantum mechanics. And every map of type E can be represented as a mixture of linear evolutions, again, the analog with cross representation. And what I'll end with is this. I will just most more or less put this up and leave it. Are type M maps equivalent, in fact, to types E, L, and I? Do we really even need those additional conditions? And in fact, At least in some cases we do. In general, we do. And this is an example. Notice this is an example from Z3. The field of scalars is, depending on how you want to represent it, 0, 1, 2, or minus 1, 0, 1. And the reason for this is that all the type M mappings, and one of the nice things about these finite vector spaces, when you look at these examples, is you can, especially for the low-dimensional vector spaces with small characteristic, you can literally write down everything that's possible. So it's possible to look at all type M maps. Turns out that all the type M maps in Z2, 2, the two-dimensional vector space over Z2, all of those, in fact, are type E, so type L and type I. So there is no distinction between type M and those maps. But when you move to Z3, 2, two-dimensional vectors over Z3, if we look at any potential linear operators in that analog to the Krauss representation, we really need a name for that representation. I guess the type L representation. The image, and we're assuming our map takes this state to this state, or the zero state to itself. In fact, these three states to themselves, but it takes this state to, and it's a map on subspaces, to the entire space, and of course takes the entire space to the entire space. And so given this assumption about this map, then, which it's easy to show that it's a type M map, we can conclude these three properties. Each of those whatever these Ks are, we don't even know how many there are, but whatever they are, they have to map these elements to these corresponding elements, and so each one of these linear operators has to be either the identity minus the identity or zero, the zero maps. But we already said that E of D minus maps to V. That's clearly not the identity or the zero map or the negative of the identity map. So here we have a type M map that isn't type E or I or L. So there is, in fact, a distinction to be made between what we take to be the sort of the basic reasonable maps and these maps that have close analogs to the completely positive maps from open quantum systems. So with that, I'll try to take any more questions.
I'm just wondering if you have any analog of entropy in this. You might think log of the dimension or something would be an entropy analog, and then given that, how about these entropy increasing theorems?
We've wondered about that. We haven't gotten any
distinction between positive and completely positive from some of the theorems.
Yeah, we haven't, at least I haven't, and I don't want to speak for Ben. Ben's had a few ideas along those lines, but I know I haven't had the opportunity to tease those out. But is there an analog in this modal notion? Do you look at the dimension of the subspace of possible states as some measure of modal entropy?
Do you know whether the dimension always increases under one of these?
I don't know that.
Just as the entropy doesn't always increase under a CP.
Oh, that's true. So what do we want?
So when you get everything mapped to a single
but there is a theorem that it does increase if it preserves the totally random density. That's a theorem. But these all preserve the totally random. Is that right? Or, I mean,
no,
is there an analog of that statement?
You could have them that didn't. That's possible. And those are allowed maps, the ones that don't preserve the whole space.
Right.
But if they did preserve the whole space, that's an interesting
question. Does the entropy then all reason?
Yeah, that's,
does
really,
the dimension,
that's a really
entropy?
Good question. That's a really good question. I don't know.
Yes, sir.
So this is a much more vague question. But have you
much more what?
Vague or ill-positive, sort of impressionistic question or something. It's because my own bias is always to think of quantum mechanics in terms of histories, right? If you like, in terms of a past integral. So I'm just wondering, I like this a lot for many reasons, but I'm having trouble seeing whether there's any history's analog. In some of our histories, we associate amplitudes with history,
mm-hmm.
and we go on from there. And you can produce probability-like numbers by squaring the amplitudes and so on. And ultimately, they can give you a kind of notion of possibility or impossibility for sets of histories, which is what you call modal. From one point of view, a lot of quantum mechanics is really in that modal assignment. But so I'm just wondering, do you know of any analog? Suppose we're thinking in a past integral mode instead of a measurement state of operational type mode. Is there some analog of all this for that?
I hate to jump in, but since I just talked back in the rules for PSI.
Sure, go please. Yeah.
Okay.
And the answer is yeah, because if you have a time evolution is a sequence of steps, each one of them represented by an invertible operator. And you can think about pick a basis and write these things all as matrices, and so the product of these matrices is in fact like a sum over histories. Through the basis, the sum over histories of the basis elements, you assign an amplitude to each one of those histories, which is the product of the transition amplitudes from the various stages of the evolution, and you add them up. Of course, you add them up in the field. These are all elements of the field, and what you get is whether the transition from the beginning to the end is possible or not. You get an amplitude, which is either zero or not zero, and so. Everything follows except that your amplitudes are elements of a discrete set, and you get just possibility information out of it, and not probabilities, and it's all discrete in time too. So it's exactly the same structure as a discrete path or a discrete path sum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe we should talk later, but. I was thinking for a little bit more, which might depend on the notion of probability or positive something.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, what you also get in the usual case is not, this. You're talking about a possibility or impossibility of transition from one starting state to one ending state. But in the other case, you can sort of, so to speak, trace out over the final ending state, and you can get, sometimes it's called the Schwinger-Keldes formalism, or if that means anything to you. And so you carry it through this way, then you would get a notion of possibility for just a set of histories without any specification of the final state.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could just say any final, maybe it's implicit in that, but anyway, that's,
mm-hmm.
anyway, it sounds.
Yes.
I have impressionistic question. Have you thought about the possibility of developing a fully axiomatic theory of open system in model theory without the concrete example of the finite fields? Because I have the impression that most of these results about the dilation of open system can be stated in
theorems, all the results are phrased in terms of vector spaces, and we're not saying there isn't an inner product space, an inner product on them. It's just that we don't take advantage of that fact. The only structures that we're using is the existence of a dual space, and what's surprising to me to get, you know, to address your impressionistic question with an impressionistic answer is, with something so simple, and that's where these examples come in, we can get results that are, you know, the results that Ben showed 2 weeks ago, like the Hardy type result and did you do no cloning?
Yeah.
Those kind of results, just the existence of superposition for that matter is somewhat surprises me. If somebody had asked me, well, does superposition somehow depend on the existence of having complex numbers, without thinking, I would have said, yeah, sure. No.
But my question was because, you know, in a sense you have a superposition principle indeed for kind of amplitudes. These vectors are nothing like in the operational framework. So you start with something that is like the ket.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be possible to talk about states and effect in a completely abstract way and still have these structures? So this is even more abstract, perhaps.
I mean, like, this people start with ortho algebras or something like that. They derive the existence of a number space. So could you start with something like that and derive the existence of a vector space?
Because I have the impression that the connection between the dilation of dynamical evolution and the fact that you can have a kind of purification of state is something that holds in a completely abstract setting, you know, this underlying vector space structure that you invoke often with the basis. That's the issue you have.
You'd have to have a better sense of what kind of axioms you're assuming for the things that you want to call kets and whatnot, but sounds like something to explore. My guess is it would take more time than we have for you to tell me what those postulates look like. Rob, I'm sorry.
So I've thought in the past about possibilistic theories that were different papers, like starting with classical discrete state space.
Yeah.
You know, possibility, impossibility. And one of the strange places I landed after thinking about that for a long time, sort of a speculative notion of how to interpret probability properly.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, maybe, you know, really our knowledge is expressed as possibilities, and probabilistic claims are just claims about, you know, out of all the possibilities, what fraction have this property you're interested in? And that's what probability is. So the response you would give to the criticism that's often made about, you know, how do you assign a prior, how do you know where to apply the Laplace's principle of indifference, would be something like, well, you know, you naturalize that question. You know, you come up with a theory that says, here are the possibilities, or here are the things which are possible or possible. And let's see how that compares to what. So anyways, I guess I'm curious whether, having thought really deeply about these things, you've had similar thoughts that maybe possibility theory underlies probability theory.
Well, only for my part, only to the extent that I've wondered if you could sort of feed in probability by hand, but just by counting possibilities and you know, how many times those crop up in a given measurement or generalized measurement, for that matter, maybe. I'll leave it at that. It's an interesting notion. I haven't thought along the lines of exactly like that, but.
Is that not what you were saying, that is the same thing?
Okay. Well, I mean, I certainly, you know, wasn't thinking about Laplace's principle of indifference because first time I've heard of it.
The problem is the probability is just you count the number of times.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, we at least I thought a little bit about that. I know Ben's thought more about it.
I guess the principle indifference thing comes in, because if you start saying probabilities like this, then you'll hear all the standard response that the frequentists get when they say this is the right way to interpret probabilities. So we kind of need to have an answer. Like Chris, for example, will say this to you, surely.
We'll find out here in a few minutes. Yes?
This is some sort of halfway house to Julio's question, which is, there's another framework, this convex set framework, which in some way you might have referred to, that people like Howard Varnum pursue. Is that, can you make tie, I mean, how close is that to this? Or is there a version of that in this setting without Hilbert space, without norms?
In that, my guess is I could take similar statements that they make about convex sets and replace those with linear spans. I'd be surprised if there aren't analogies to be made. But I shouldn't say too much about that, because I'm just barely aware of what Howard and Alex have been working on in terms of context sets.
They do use probabilities, right?
It's awfully hard to define a convex set,
right,
without restricting oneself to numbers that are between, that are between 0 and 1.
Presumably, what we'd have to do is come up with something else where you just put X's or not in your tables, whether that combination of measurements is possible. Mm-hmm. And so that I suppose that's possible. Yeah, but
even independently of the sort of the Mohashed aspects of convex sets, this sort of corresponding operational structure that people think of, where you say, well, you have boxes that correspond to operations, and this is a preparation, this is a transformation, you have more complicated relations, the circuits and so on.
Mm-hmm.
There's a kind of mathematics associated with that sort of operationalism. And it might be nice to, and I think this might be what Julia meant, is put the axioms in that kind of framework.
Right.
You know, I think you have this box and this box, you have some axioms sort of corresponding to that, and that one itself has to be.
So replace the word probability with possibility and do the same stuff.
Yeah. So you have a circuit represented by a bunch of boxes, and then you ask, is this circuit possible or not? And that bears.
So you're saying in the language of monoidal category.
But the key thing is to replace probability with possibility.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So every picture is either possible or not.
Can you, if there are no more questions, we can conclude the seminar here and continue with the informal discussion. So,
okay.
Okay, so let's thank you.